It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the annual Assembly of Nations involved in the International Criminal Court starts today in New York. We'll find out what's on the agenda and how it could impact the United States. First, the president's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI on Friday. Flynn says he lied about conversations with the Russian ambassador. Documents were released as part of Flynn's plea agreement, which indicates that he'll be cooperating with the probe led by Robert Mueller. Frank Turkheimer is an emeritus professor of law at UW-Madison Law School and a former Wisconsin-based federal prosecutor. He joins us now to look at the legal implications of the plea deal and what could be next. Frank, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, when you look at Michael Flynn's plea deal, his pleading guilty to one charge of many possible charges, apparently, what was your reaction?
Well, my reaction was the same as we've heard on with different analysts, that he's got something to offer, that what he's told the special counsel, he's told them things which the special counsel will feel are useful for future prosecution. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And lying to the FBI is the only charge against Flynn right now. There had been talks about him not disclosing relationships with the nation of Turkey, among other things. Do you think that was maybe part of a plea agreement, or are those kind of being held in reserve in case he doesn't cooperate?
Well, I think that if he doesn't cooperate is fairly unlikely at this point. I mean, he's the leverage on him is not only his own criminality, but I think there's some criminality, potential criminality by his son. And I think I've heard reference to the fact that this agreement was reached in part for family reasons. Well, I don't think it's just so he can spend more time with his kids. I think it has something to do with his son as well. So the hammer that's over his head is quite lethal.
And then looking at the Trump administration in general, again, we have limited information about what all has gone on behind the scenes, but it appears that Flynn referred to talking to a senior official about his conversation with the Russian ambassador, possibly implicating someone who might also have said that didn't happen. Is that a thread that they're likely to follow, the Mueller investigation?
I would think so. I don't see how you cannot follow it. I mean, generally speaking, when you make plea agreements, you want to work your way up. And if somebody gave Flynn instructions or directions at somebody over him, it would be totally abnormal to ignore that and not pursue it.
I've seen the argument made that something that might have the Trump administration worried is that the Mueller probe has been very low on leaks. The things that are coming out, they're not telegraphed miles away. Do you agree with that assessment?
I think that's right. I think Mueller is a highly conscientious, well-regarded attorney who has had a long and distinguished career in law enforcement, and his leaks is not part of his technique.
And the president's Twitter account, and I'll explain why I don't say this is the president, but on the president's Twitter account, he mentions that lying to the FBI was one of the reasons that Flynn was fired, which is different from the original story, which was just that Flynn had misled members of the administration. Since then, a lawyer, an advisor to President Trump said, oh, I sent that tweet. Is it possible for the president to reveal information that he shouldn't have on his Twitter account? And do you think this is a problem?
Well, when you say shouldn't have, I mean, it's certainly not the president's interest for him to acknowledge that he knew at the time he fired the head of the FBI that Flynn had committed a crime. I mean, that's clearly whatever obstruction of justice case there might exist against the president is enhanced by an acknowledgement that at the time he spoke to Comey, he knew that Flynn had in fact violated the law.
And one of the president's legal counselors has made the case just over the last day or so that the president can't obstruct justice. The president is the highest justice official in effect in the country. What do you make of that argument?
Well, when Richard Nixon was impeached, the House Judiciary Committee voted 38 to nothing, with all 21 Democrats and 17 Republicans voting to impeach him for obstruction of justice. So, I mean, you don't have to go back to the origins of the Constitution to find precedent for saying that obstruction of justice is an impeachable offense.
Do you think it's likely that we're going to end up there with the accusations of obstruction of justice against the president leading to impeachment?
That's a tough question. During the Watergate matter, which is what now about 40 years ago, you had a Republican president and a Democratic-controlled House and Senate. During the Clinton impeachment period of about 20 years ago, you had a Democratic president and a Republican House and Senate. Now we've got a situation that we haven't had, namely a Republican president and a Republican-controlled House and Senate. And whether the Republicans in the House are prepared to gear up the impeachment machinery to impeach one of their own is a problematic question. It's not the same situation.
Is impeachment the only legal mechanism against a sitting president? You can't bring them into a court for the most part, isn't that right?
Well, you know, it's an unresolved question. Recent history tells us that when an independent counsel, which the Watergate prosecutor in one case and Ken Starr in the other, find that the president has violated the law, they don't opt to indict the president, but rather refer to the House for possible impeachment. So, you know, it's not a clear question. Happily, in our 200-plus-year history, this issue has not come up with any frequency, so there's no precedent to guide us. And the only precedent we do have is that when an independent counsel or special prosecutor finds evidence of presidential criminality, the answer is to send it to the House. That's the remedy.
Talking to Frank Turkheimer, Emeritus Professor of Law at UW-Madison's Law School, also a federal prosecutor, former federal prosecutor. Let's talk about pardon power, Professor Turkheimer. The president could hypothetically pardon somebody like Michael Flynn. I've seen the case made that some of the charges not being filed at the federal level are being held out there so that maybe state prosecutors could bring them, which are then immune to the president's pardon power.
Right. The president can pardon both offenses before or after they've been committed. It's clear that the presidential pardon power is that broad, but as you point out, it's only for crimes committed against the United States, leaving anyone vulnerable to state prosecution. Now, federal obstruction of justice as a general matter is not going to be within the jurisdiction of any local prosecutor, and violating regulations or rules relating to whom you have to register with when you act on behalf of a foreign country, that's really not within the ambit of most local prosecutors. So with respect to Flynn, I'd say that, you know, without knowing more about other possible criminality, I'd say local prosecution is pretty unlikely. The place where you might have an avenue for local prosecution is with money laundering. And we're not talking about Flynn there, but clearly money laundering is in the ambit of local prosecutors, especially the New York the Attorney General and the New York County DA's office. So that's a separate matter.
And the president has tweeted criticizing the FBI, saying it was in disarray after years under James Comey. It's been taken by former FBI agents as a criticism, kind of out of bounds criticism. As a former federal prosecutor, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I just don't think that has any basis in reality. I mean, it's been a few years since I've worked with the FBI, but I'm in touch with former agents whom I worked with, and the idea that it's in disarray, I think, is nonsense. I mean, the FBI is a very solid, reputable institution that has prides itself on its independence and its integrity, and I think these statements are just nonsense.
And is there a next shoe you're watching for to drop in this investigation?
Well, you know, there have been so many surprises that I don't think I want to be in the business of predicting next shoes. I do think that, as you suggested earlier, it's very likely that the special counsel will go up the chain with respect to who told Flynn to deal with the Russians, and that would be my guess, but that's not a particularly original analysis.
Frank, thanks a lot for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
That's Frank Turkheimer, Emeritus Professor of Law at UW-Madison's Law School and a former federal prosecutor. He joined us to look at the Russia investigation after the president's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. Right now, the annual Assembly of State Parties to the International Criminal Court starts today in New York, kicking off a 10-day event. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is wrapping up its work, and the ICC is now turning its attention to Afghanistan, where a war crimes inquiry could include American soldiers. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with Thierry Cruvillier. He's the only journalist in the world who has attended and reported on all of the important post-Cold War international tribunals. He's a visiting professor at UW-Madison teaching a course on international criminal justice.
Just a couple of weeks ago, former Bosnian Serb General Ratko Mladic was found guilty of committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. How significant is that Mladic verdict?
Well, obviously it's significant because Mladic was probably the key character in the war in Bosnia. And it sort of completes the work of the Yugoslav court and makes it clear that the nature of the crimes that were committed during that war in the early 90s and the responsibility of these main leaders. So in that sense, it's a confirmation, a judicial confirmation on what historians and journalists or whoever has worked on this period of history know. It's also the end of the work of these tribunals. So symbolically, it's about 20 more years of justice in the Balkans that is roughly coming to an end, although national courts in these countries still work. So it's not over, but it's over at the international level in a large measure. So in that sense, it's a symbolic moment. The downside maybe is that the hope that justice would sort of help change the political dynamics in the Balkans and the relationships between the former nations of Yugoslavia. That hope was just a hope. The situation today in the Balkans is that nationalism is still on the rise. Former war criminals are praised and legitimized. And it seems to be a country that is as divided as ever.
You have attended all of the trials brought before contemporary international tribunals for war crimes and crimes against humanity. How much does a verdict or this kind of ending of a long process mean to victims and survivors?
It's always hard to tell because we don't really have proper surveys. We're going to always have a number of victims, expressing themselves. But my experience is that what these kind of trials mean to victims can vary tremendously. And so it's a bit difficult to have an idea of what is it that the victims in general feel or understand or accept. So I wouldn't want to venture in these kind of speculations. You're going to have a whole range of reactions, I suppose. Some of them will be very satisfied. For some of them who are silent, maybe they found other ways to deal with what happened. And trials, punishment is not necessarily the answer to every victim, except that those ones we may not hear about them or from them. So it's a whole range of reactions. Certainly, victims in Bosnia will be satisfied. There is little doubt about it. Again, as I said, it seems to be a bit difficult beyond Bosnia and beyond the Bosniak Muslim community how it's going to be perceived because of these nationalist positions that political leaders are still taking in the region, in Serbia or Croatia.
The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia also sentenced former Bosnian Croat General Slobodan Praljak this week. As the judge at The Hague read out the verdict confirming his 20-year prison term for war crimes, something very unexpected happened. He pulled out a vial of poison and killed himself.
And drank it and killed himself.
Yeah, after rejecting the verdict. Does that taint the work of the tribunal?
A number of commentators have said so, and I'm not sure I really see why in the long run. I do understand that, yes, it gives nationalists a sort of a great picture to say how this court is unfair and how the war criminals that they I mean, the individuals that they take as war criminals are actually national heroes. And that kind of heroic kind of gesture may help them. But I don't think in the long run that's necessarily something that would last. The conviction was established. I think the facts are pretty strong. And it's spectacular, but it happens. It happens. Remember Göring at Nuremberg. It's not a first. It's very spectacular because it happens inside the courtroom and in front of cameras. But it's not a first, and these are the kind of events that can happen in any of these courts. Of course, it's very rare. And of course, the fact that it happens at the very, very end of the existence of the tribunal makes it a symbol. And a number of commentators have actually said it was a fitting finale for the court. Yes, perhaps, like, you know, it's a good line. But I'm not sure that in the long run it will be like a major event that will be remembered.
Thierry Cuvelier is the only journalist in the world who has attended and reported on all of the important post-Cold War international tribunals. He's a visiting professor at UW-Madison teaching a course on international criminal justice. And Thierry, the 10-day annual Assembly of State Parties to the International Criminal Court starts today in New York. What will happen there?
Well, technically, that's where they have to sort of vote the budget. That's like probably the key outcome of this National Assembly. What is interesting perhaps this year is that it also happens at a time where international criminal justice is in deep crisis. The International Criminal Court lacks credibility a lot. It is challenged by a number of states, and it is challenged for its mediocre achievements and the poor quality of its trials and the low productivity of the court. So we are at a different stage now in this evolution of international tribunals over the last 25 years. And it's a time of credibility crisis and legitimacy. It also, simultaneously, what is interesting is that at the same time that the court is in crisis, it is also asked to get involved in many more situations. In Afghanistan and Burundi, the court had decided to open investigations a few weeks ago. And on top of it, NGOs, human rights organizations, are asking the court to get involved in Myanmar, in the crisis of the Rohingyas in Burma, where it has no jurisdiction, so it would need the United Nations Security Council to decide for it, and it probably won't happen because China and Russia would probably oppose that. Or perhaps the U.S. I don't even know if the U.S. would support it. And so it's a bizarre situation where the court is probably taking even more work when it's already struggling in achieving something significant.
As you mentioned, the International Criminal Court is considering opening an investigation into Afghanistan. The United States is not a participant in the ICC, but that Afghanistan inquiry could involve U.S. soldiers. So what would happen, Thierry, if the ICC decides to do this investigation? U.S. troops are implicated, but the U.S. has not ratified the ICC.
So technically, the court, yes, the United States are not a member of the ICC, but Afghanistan is. And as a result, anyone committing crimes in Afghanistan can fall under the jurisdiction of the ICC. So the ICC opening an investigation in Afghanistan, we know it's official in a way. I mean, we know what they have in mind, which is that the crimes from the Taliban are probably the primary targets. Then comes crimes from the Afghan National Forces, Defense Forces, and crimes committed by U.S. soldiers and CIA agents in some detention centers. We're talking about torture and rape, mainly in the years of probably 2003-2004. And of course, it's very sensitive, because that would be the first time that the ICC targets a major power. And that's the context I think we have to see it in, is that the ICC has been very criticized for only targeting African states and weaker states. And it has to prove that it can go beyond the African continent and also target major powers. So it has two investigations at the moment now, which is one in Georgia, where actually Russian troops are in the pipeline. And it's a way to balance politically, I guess, their investigations by having Afghanistan that would target the U.S. Now, let's also be reasonable. If it happens, we know that they have it in mind, but who knows what can happen in the meantime. If it happens, it's going to be very small. We're talking probably of a maximum of a handful of individuals. So let's keep in mind that this is a highly symbolic gesture. But the relationship between the United States and the ICC has been complicated. And under the Bush administration, it was a very hostile relationship. Since then, there has been some sort of mutual accommodation between the two. And so what are we going to see? Either the United States is going to ignore entirely the ICC because it's irrelevant or because it's just, you know, easy to deal with it. It seems a bit unlikely. The most likely is that they revert to a much more hostile policy. But it's impossible to tell at the moment. And it's going to probably take years from now before any indictment is coming out of the court. So it's an event. It's important. And at the same time, we have to keep in mind that it's symbolic, much more than really significant.
Thierry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thierry Cruvellier is a journalist covering the International Criminal Court. He talked to Judith Sears-Poisson. And Judith, there's more where that came from.
There is. Thierry and I continued speaking after that interview about what it's like to spend 20 years covering these war crimes tribunals around the world. That additional interview is available at WPR.org and on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Now, on the first Monday of each month, WPR director Mike Crane, or director of content Mike Arnold, joins the morning show, or us here on Central Time, to share information about Wisconsin Public Radio and to answer your questions. And we want to hear your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about programming or news coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio? What do you want to hear more of or less of on WPR? What do you want to know about the behind-the-scenes stuff? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. WPR Director Mike Crane is in the studio with us. Mike, welcome back.
It's good to be here.
Well, a couple fresh pieces of news, one public, one behind the scenes. I want to start with an Emmy for our colleagues from Wisconsin Public Television, and we were part of that for Wisconsin Life. Tell us about
that. That's right. So Emmys are given out for achievement in television, but this was a really wonderful partnership. People listening may or may not know that Wisconsin Life is both a TV and a radio, and actually an online project as well for Wisconsin Public Broadcasting, and something we worked on together, which the name of the animated piece is called Big Mama, and it's a wonderful story of Cynthia Woodland and her family they won the Outstanding Crafts Achievement in Graphic Arts and Animation for the Midwestern version of the Emmys. And a whole bunch of people were involved, including Ann Strainchamps, who helped to produce the original radio commentary that Cynthia did a couple of years ago. And then TV's Philip Ashby and Rodney Lambright and Scott Stetson, among others, were involved. Our own Joe Hartke, who is behind the scenes doing audio stuff all the time, he did the audio mix, the sound design, as they call it in the TV world, for that. And also thanks to Christine Sloan Miller and Erica Janik, who partnered TV and radio together to make the Wisconsin Life partnership go. All of that leading to just a wonderful animation. I encourage you to go find it at wisconsinlife.org because I think you'll really enjoy it. One other Emmy thing while I'm on it, there was also another involvement we had with an Emmy. The Wisconsin Winter from the Air incredible video earned an Emmy as well, and the audio was recorded in Eau Claire for the narration. And that narration was done by Michael Perry, the wonderful author and host of Tent Show Radio.
Those Wisconsin from the Air series are a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I love those. And some behind-the-scenes news now, a milestone for a definitely a behind-the-scenes person who's made a big difference, Denny Ryan.
Yeah, Denny is our music librarian and has been for quite a long time now. But Denny, we know now, started as a student on the first Monday of December. So here we are on the first Monday in December. In 1969. So he's been with us all the time and really, you're right, behind the scenes, but contributes so much to our work and make sure that we can get all the music on and all that. And he does it with just a nice quiet style. And we love Denny, and it's great to be able to mention his achievement here.
I understand one of his early achievements was carrying crates of LPs to move public radio into Vilas Hall here.
That's right. And that's way heavier than CDs, and we still have some of those.
Because, and way heavier than digital music.
You're not kidding. And some of those LPs are still here because some things were never issued on CD.
I want to look at some other news going on here. The WPR News Department has a documentary coming up, part of their year-long series, State of Change. We've been playing their pieces here on Central Time, but they've got a big shindig coming up with
that's
that.
That's right. It's a compilation. Actually, people have been asking me, where's Maureen McCollum on the other network? She's normally the morning host on the News and Classical Network. Well, she's been working on this State of Change documentary, collecting all the work together, and has an able substitute in Rachel Vasquez. So the weekend after next is when we're going to be broadcasting this State of Change documentary. So you'll hear promos on the air. It'll be on both networks because we want a lot of people to have a chance to hear how it's all pulled together and therefore to have a vision of how the state of Wisconsin is changing.
Now, public radio and the news, again, unfortunately for a bad reason, part of the wave of sexual assault and harassment charges. The latest, Garrison Keillor now, his relationship ended with our colleagues in Minnesota, at Minnesota Public Radio. What's the latest, and how's that going to affect programming here, too, Mike?
Well, probably not that much at the moment, thank goodness. The main thing that happened with that severing of relationship in terms of what Minnesota Public Radio is doing with the formerly known as a Prairie Home Companion is that they're going to change the name. But probably more important in terms of change of programming is that Chris Thiele, who's now the host, has been in a lot of ways kind of recreating what had been done on the now previously named show. But he's got a lot of ideas and a great crew of people around him to continue to revise the show and make it contemporary for today's audience needs. And so I'd say keep tuning in on Saturday afternoons and find out what Chris and the whole crew is up to.
It's Mondays with Mike Crane, the boss of all bosses here at Wisconsin Public Radio, is with us, sharing some of the latest news. We'll have some more as we go on, but also taking your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Stanley is with us in Augusta. Stanley, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask Mike, are we ever going to see the return of any Wisconsin-based long-term or long format, as in hour-long programming, during a time period when I'm awake, because I do realize there's still the 3 hours in the morning. When I first started listening to the Ideas Network, it was, generally speaking, all hour-long format, primarily Wisconsin-based programs, and we've now got, you know, 4 hours of national programming and really nothing in the midday of Wisconsin-based long-format programming.
Thanks, Stanley, for the question. I heard you probably deliberately excluding this program, Central Time, from the list because
we're not long, we're not hour-long conversations.
That's right, and I do understand that. And part of, to me, the insight of Central Time is that if everything were hour-long conversations, there would be a lot of conversations we would miss. And so that's why we're doing Central Time in a different way than some of those previous shows. Our current plan is to continue doing the morning show, maybe with some differences that will arise from a new host. I know even as the temporary host, Kate Archer-Kent has been a great influence on how they're doing the show. And, you know, I want to give you a really definite answer, but I'd say I'm not exactly sure how that show will be reshaped over time, but the idea that we're going to have lots of opportunities for the people of Wisconsin to have conversation with each other through our radio, that's definitely continuing. It's really the distinctive thing that we do. As it speaks to the 1 o'clock slot, where it was Kathleen Dunn, we're hearing some pretty good things about 1A, and we've generally been pretty pleased here inside the radio with how that's going. And what it's allowing us to do is to look at whether some of our resources could be deployed elsewhere rather than picking up another hour-long or two-hour-long program in the afternoon. That may not be that satisfying, Stanley, but that's kind of where things stand at this time.
Stanley, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Some more news coming up, Mike. I wanted to mention the pledge drive. Last pledge drive of 2017 starts by my clock tomorrow.
It does. That's why the pledge drive number is actually right in front of our eyes here.
And we're trying not to say it yet.
We'll leave the call in there. But yeah, this is our year-end pledge drive. We've made a bit of a shift over time. We used to have three pledge drives. Now we have four, but they're all shorter. And the sense there that we've had is that, first of all, the year-end is a great time to encourage people to support any kind of nonprofits or charities. And so we wanted to do that in this time frame. And we also know that when we're doing a pledge drive, God bless those of you that stick around, but some people don't. And so we want to make sure that they're as good as they can be and as short as they can be to help fund WPR.
Let's go back to our callers now. Wayne is on the line in Marshfield. Wayne, hi.
Hi. I have two items. One is like a grammar police. there's an announcement periodically about the 9XM leadership group, and the statement is $100 a month or more, and I'm not sure $100 or more per month.
Ah.
But when it's a month or more, does that modify the dollars or the month?
I never thought of it that way, Wayne, no. But you're right, because I could give $100 if it's a month or more. If I give $100 in the course of the millennium, I'm there.
Yeah.
Okay, good grammar point. What was your other point, Wayne?
The other point is the website is given all the time, but there is never any phone numbers. And in our retirement building here, I would estimate 15 to 25% of people do not use internet connections, and of course, they're left out if they want to ever make a contact. Other than, of course, this program, the calling programs always give the number, but when it mentions the trips or other information, a phone number is never given, and I kind of miss that. I feel cheated.
Wayne, thank you so much. Mike, that's something to think about. Not everybody uses the internet as their main point of reference.
Yeah, that is right, and it's probably a good reminder for us to give out the audience services number that we do have, and that frankly, despite thinking, oh, no one uses the phone anymore, our audience services team is busier
than
ever.
They're always getting calls.
Yeah.
It's true.
And so someone's finding the number, but that's a good thing, and we'll take that to the team to remember to give out at least that audience services number, because they're very willing to help people and direct them to the information.
I'm asking for that audience service number now because I should have it memorized, Mike, and I don't. Hey, I almost forgot what the pledge drive. There's a special thank you gift available. The food bank?
Oh,
right?
Yes, that's right. And one of the things we've been doing for quite a while during this drive is instead of having the usual tchotchkes, that you have an opportunity to make your pledge of support and help people that are experiencing what I've learned to call food insecurity. You know, they may not in fact be starving or anything like that, but they don't always know where their next meal comes from. And so we're working with the Second Harvest Feeding America folks. Mm-hmm. To make sure that meals that would be near your address, that's part of it, that would be provided for people as a result of your pledging to Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm wearing one of those tchotchkes now, the WPR t-shirt.
Other times we can give
okay.
those out. That's great.
Well, I just don't want to look down on them.
No.
Mike Crane is with us, WPR director. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about Wisconsin Public Radio on the air or behind the scenes? Is there something you especially like and want to hear more of or dislike and want to hear less of? Call 800-642-1234. You can also email at ideas@wpr.org. Before I forget, the audience services number is not the number to call in to talk on the air. But for future reference, it is 800-747-7444. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our visit with Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. What questions do you have or comments do you have for Mike about Wisconsin Public Radio programming? Do you have thoughts on our on-air content, our website, you name it? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Mike is with us in Rice Lake. Mike, hi.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
And just, I know you've got mixed reviews on the 1A program. I've been listening to it since you put it on here a few months ago. And while I understand some folks, you know, miss the Wisconsin focus of Kathleen Dunn's show, but I enjoy 1A because the issues they're talking about are national issues, but they usually have an impact here in Wisconsin. And while some might not like that it comes out of D.C. or whatever, I think it's important to hear that viewpoint. And it also, it gives you an idea how the national thing is when it's looking at a particular topic, and they focus on one or two things a day. And I like the program. Thanks for putting it on.
Well, thanks so much for the comment, Mike. You are right that probably it even depicts the instincts of WPR going back to nearly 100 years ago when we started doing audio programming, not just the dots and dashes of Morse code. And that is that there's an instinct both to bring the nation and even the world to us here in Wisconsin and to reflect upon ourselves as well. And over time, the mix does change. I mean, our basic habit in terms of new programs is to try to let them settle for a while and see what the reaction is. We are not typically hasty.
Mm-hmm. Jury's still out on Central Time, for example.
That's right.
It's only been like 4 years.
4 years, that's right. And I am very, I mentioned this earlier with Stanley's call that we are interested in seeing whether kind of redeploying our resources a bit would make the work of everybody more sustainable, because everybody here, and I love working with everybody, and they work so hard for you. And so being able to have a little extra help here and there might just be the thing. Thanks.
Mike, thanks a lot. And that was like the best sounding phone line I've ever heard. There should be a legal mandate that everybody has a phone that good to be on the radio. I'll go next to Sally on the line in Beaver Dam. I'm a nerd. I really pay attention to phone line quality. Sally, hi. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One of the critiques I would have is that with Central Time, and maybe it's only the time that I listen to it, but I get very frustrated when it seems like the segments are about 20 minutes long. And then the topic changes. And then at the end of that 20 minutes or thereabouts, callers are invited to call in, yet there's never any time to call in because then you're on to the next topic. And maybe, you know, it's just my perception again or the times that I'm tuning in, but that just absolutely drives me crazy and it makes me not want to listen to the program anymore. That's all I really had to say.
Well, thanks, Sally. That's an interesting thing, Rob. From a sort of a functional standpoint, mm-hmm. I imagine we could invite the calls earlier so people could get in. I don't know.
That's something we do sometimes, yeah. And generally, so this is maybe too much detail. When we have a half-hour conversation is when we're going to pretty much always invite calls, and we'll do that midway through. And usually, depending on the topic, there are full phone lines, and we get some callers in there. Sometimes for shorter segments, we do a thing where we only take callers. And we creatively call those, you're not going to believe this, Mike, we call them caller-only segments. Pretty creative.
Amazing. Yes.
And we'll get lots of callers that we bring in on those 15 minutes. Sally's right. If you're used to the hour-long conversations that our earlier caller was talking about, where it's, you know, 20 minutes of conversation, then 40 minutes of calls, it's true. We're not going to get as many callers on for something like that.
One of the things that I know we're trying to do more effectively, and it surprises me in a way that we weren't doing as much of this, but each of the shows can tend to be islands unto themselves. Mm-hmm. And so part of the sensitivity we're trying to get is, well, if we've talked about it in the afternoon for 20 minutes and it really deserved an hour, then maybe we can come back to it in the morning sometime. Because some topics we thought they would be brief, but in fact, lots of people want to call in.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call, Sally. We go now to John in Grays Lake, Illinois. John, hi.
Hey, I always just quickly second. I like same Central Time. I like the shorter little blurbs, so please keep that up. What I really called for, though, was that Saturday mornings, I used to really like the variety of programming. Now they seem to be all quiz shows, one after the other. So just hoping to see if there's a way to get either some local-grown show or bring one in from another station. that has a little more variety than just quiz shows.
Thanks, John. You'll remember having listened long enough that we used to have Car Talk there. And in fact, because it was hard to find something new that did as well as Car Talk, we did the best of Car Talk for a good number of years. And it finally just got to the point where the folks at the Car Talk production said, we got nothing. You can still hear it on a podcast, but it's all repeats now at this point. And the thing that arrived in the midst of that was the Tell Me Another, the quiz show, which seemed to be doing well for a lot of stations, and that's why we have it there. But yes, we are actually trying to figure out how to develop new programs. You may have had a chance to hear some of the WPR Next pilots that we worked on, and some of those might turn into the next Saturday or Sunday hit, but we're kind of still in early days about figuring that out. It turns out, and I've seen this over the years, it can take literally years to develop another hit show, and we definitely want to try.
John, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mike Crane, director of WPR. Back to your calls now. Nick is on the line in Fond du Lac. Nick, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I just wanted to say that I absolutely love Central Time. It's my favorite. I'm a truck driver, and whenever I'm coming through Wisconsin, I mean, I'm from Green Bay area, but whenever I come back home and I get to listen to WPR, it's so nice because it is so much better than, I mean, I'm not even exaggerating, it is so much better than most public radio in the country.
Nick, thank you so much for the kind words about the Ideas Network and about our show. But, Mike, this is a quandary, though, because there are going to be some people who really miss that, we're not doing the hour-long things, and some people who really love that we're doing shorter conversations. I've worked on both kinds of the show. I have an affection for both kinds, so I'm not just on one side or the other.
And I have an affection for the local shows and the national shows and the quiz shows and the not-quiz shows. Here's the thing, and it's an insoluble problem, but one that most of us love in balance, and that is that a radio station, by necessity, is something that's for a mass audience. And so any one thing might not satisfy us as listeners, but hopefully, and I think this is definitely true given 54,000 members and lots of listeners, that overall it's a satisfying source of entertainment and information and helping you be a better citizen, all of that. And so, Nick, I almost feel like we should use you as the cue up to the pledge drive phone number, but we won't. That's tomorrow. But it's great to hear your comments and everybody's comments.
Thanks a lot for that call. Couple more items I want to get out there. It's a great place to listen. It's a great place to work, too, Mike. I understand we have some job openings.
We do, and we're actually going to have a few more posted in the near term. In fact, I was looking today. There's a position description for a chief development officer that we'll have posted pretty soon. But right now at WPR.org/jobs, you'll find a host for Morning Drive. That's we're generically called the morning show for the moment here on the Ideas Network. Also for a radio board operator announcer, an audience services receptionist, and a membership support specialist. And you'll find those and other opportunities as they come along. And even if you're not sure you'd be interested, if there's someone you think might be, go ahead to WPR.org/jobs and send them the link, because the more we can reach out to people that might love to work here, the better.
Well, Mike, it's been good working with you today. Thanks a lot for joining us on the show again.
Always a pleasure. See you in 2 months, I think.
Yep. Well, I'll probably see you around the office before.
Oh, okay.
That's Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. He joined us for Mondays with Mike here on Central Time. He and Mike Arnold, another head honcho here, switch off between us and the morning show. Next chance to listen, Monday, January 8th at 8 a.m. You can't wait until then for a comment. You can call Audience Services. Dial in at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444. They're really friendly, and they can help answer your questions or pass along your comments. When life gives you oranges, make orangeade. That's what Badger football fans are doing as tickets go on sale for the Orange Bowl against Miami. After this weekend's loss to Ohio State knocked Wisconsin out of that shot at the national championship, producer Dean Kinetter is feeling the pain. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
I watched. You watched?
I was riding the emotional roller coaster the whole night. This was a big one.
It was a big one. I mean, such an opportunity for Wisconsin to be in the playoff, the championship playoff.
It had the feel of the 94 Rose Bowl in the sense that the Badgers could reach another level on the national stage, but unfortunately it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, and did you have high hopes going in, or were you?
I was optimistic. Like, okay. I felt like it was their time, but Ohio State got in the way as they always do.
And now, I don't want to be too negative about this. This was a heck of a season, and I keep thinking back, if we traveled back in time 30 years and told Badger fans, you know, when they were going 1-10 and 9th and 10th in the Big Ten, which was 10 teams, mm-hmm. hey, you're going to have a shot at the national championship, they would have said, hey, what's a national championship playoff? And B, no way.
There were some dark times, and they've become one of the most consistently good programs in the whole country, and that's a testament to what they built here in Wisconsin, and, you know, they represent the state and the school in a really good way, so you're not going to find me rooting for anyone else.
A lot of good players coming back?
I hope so.
All right, thanks a lot, Dean. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.